And I thought what I'd do to start is to give you a little bit of biology class. So we're going to have an opportunity to sit back and just look at the pretty flowers, some slides of pretty flowers, and some nice weeds here in front of us. But I also want to give you a little bit of a biology class at the beginning, so bear with me for that part, just to give you some common terminology that I can use and we can use to talk about it. And also, to show you how flowering plants fit in the bigger picture of plant life in general in nature. So I have a diagram here I'll start with. Now let's see, they kind of give it a little bit of a visual effect, actually.
Yes, we do need, because they're shading flowering plants.
Chair. And everyone read that. We won't have to read this very often, but I just wanted to just to show you that when we're talking about flowering plants, we're really talking about one phylum of all of the things that we call plants. And that all of these different phyla, different groups, have very different life cycles, very different structures. And so when we're talking about flowering plants, we'll use terminology that in most cases, isn't going to apply to the rest of the plant kingdom, but only to these. Okay, that's the limit of that. This is a classification I want to show you with a couple other things. Sometimes we use this term vascular plants, and those are the kinds of plants that I study. And I just wanted to point out that vascular plants are those that have tissue specialized for transport of water and nutrients. So that doesn't include mosses and liverworts, which are also plants, also part of this kingdom, but don't have specialized tissue. You can imagine that if you didn't have that kind of tissue, you'd be very limited in size. And indeed, that's the case. Okay? So this is where we are in the overall scheme of things, flowering plants. And
is it true that the DNA of a vascular plant is more complex than ours, that of ourselves?
I don't know that I can answer that. It's true that flowering plants, or even more primitive plants like ferns, have many more chromosomes than we do. And some of the sedges have many more chromosomes than we do. So whether or not they're genetically more complicated, It'd be hard for me to answer. I don't know the number of genes, which would be one measure. The genetic makeup, DNA makeup of organisms is so complex. There's many multiple copies of some parts of the DNA component that we have, and so you might have even in a process of hybridization, a doubling or a quadrupling of the whole genetic makeup of an organism. So right there, you've gone fourfold increase without any apparent change in complexity that's visible. So, well, I don't want to show you this. I'm looking at flowers today. So this is a diagram of a flower, and it's labeled a typical complete flower for a couple of reasons. One is it's a typical, meaning it doesn't really look like any flower that you'll see. But it's a diagram showing the basic parts of a flower. And the term complete just means that it has those four parts, which I'll describe here. A flower is a very specific unit of the reproductive structure of a flowering plant. And later on, when we talk about inflorescences, which are clusters of flowers, it's important to keep that distinct, what this single flower is. For example, this thing right here is not a flower, but it's an inflorescence. It's a group of hundreds of flowers put together. So if we dissect this out, which we'll do if we have time, we can find a single flower within this inflorescence. Sort of a larger example, this is an inflorescence also. And one of these is a flower. Maybe this seems very basic to you, but sometimes it's not so obvious. Like, how many people knew this was not just a flower? Nobody knew that. Oh, well, all right. Well, look, you're going to learn a lot then.
You have a just basic 50, group here.
Yeah. Just 50 minutes. Okay, that's good. You know, I'm sorry if I started out sort of roughly. I usually like to, let me back up even more. I usually do field seminars with about 12 people. And it's usually out in the field where we can do a lot more hands-on and interactive kinds of stuff. So it's a little different format to have a group of people just sitting and looking, but I'm assuming everybody speaks English. and other languages too, I'm sure. But and
is that Latin we need
them? You might need some Latinized terminology. I'll use a little bit of Latin. Can't help but use a little bit. And there's nobody that has a PhD in botany here. Or Atlantic College.
We believe.
Okay, right. I'll try not to deceive you. I'm very comfortable saying I don't know, so that's a good thing. Obviously, that's a good thing for
us. Some of us haven't had biology for over 30 years.
Yeah, there you go.
30 years. Okay. Maybe, well, yeah, if you had biology 30 years ago, you were probably told there were plants and animals.
I remember that. I remember the word phylum, actually.
Okay. Well, I don't want you to memorize phylum and all that stuff, or Norwichian, probably, if I wanted to, but back when I went to school also, which is more than 30 years ago, they told me they were plants and animals. That's how it classified living things, plants and animals. Well, now we divide living things into at least five kingdoms that are given more or less equal status. Plants are one of those kingdoms, and animals are in one of those kingdoms. But a lot of things that we might have called plants aren't, like fungi. We're not going to talk about fungi because those aren't plants by the modern classification. And seaweeds aren't plants by modern classification. They're an algae. They have a very different life cycle and structure. So those aren't too germane to our topic today of just talking about flowers, but maybe we can use that as a pointer to the fact that we're talking about an infinite subject. Really, and we're all at some stage of understanding this infinite subject. And so we just bite off a little bit as we can, whatever amount we can, or are interested in biting off. And it might be that your interest is just learning the names of a few of the flowers around Holden. Or you may wish to pursue it much further. So I feel like if I learn a little bit every day, I keep progressing along the lines of what I'm interested in.
So Joe, I'm already lost. That's not a flower.
That's a flower.
This is, how many people think this is a flower? Okay. How many think it's one flower?
One flower.
Okay, this is one flower. So if you're with me there.
What's the daisy?
And the daisy is an inflorescence, which is an assemblage of flowers. So there may be 100 flowers in this head. And this is called a head. That's a good botanical term, and it's a type of inflorescence. And this is another inflorescence, which is called a raceme, and might not be important for you to know that, but it's another type of inflorescence. You could imagine this raceme through time going through changes where it becomes condensed into a head, and each of these flowers became smaller, so they fit in this head. Maybe you can understand how this is an inflorescence, the same as this is.
An inflorescence means?
A group of flowers.
Group of flowers.
Right. Okay. It's great that you ask questions, and I encourage you to interrupt me anytime, because that's how I understand what you understand, and that we're all speaking, we're all at the same language. And I could just tell you the names of a few of the flowering plants around here. And I will do that. Like, this is foxglove, which you might know. And this is a non-native species. We use the term non-native in a technical sense to mean species that weren't here when European settlement first occurred. So that's kind of our definition. Doesn't mean it's any better or worse than anything else, but it's just a terminology. that we use. So this is a non-native species. It also happens to be a weed. And a weed is also can be a neutral term that means different things to different people. You know, weed is in some ways just something you want to remove. But weed is also something that is able to go into disturbed sites and seed itself in and start to grow. And this is a weed because it does that. We have native weeds also that have that same mechanism that can go into a disturbed site and start to grow. And sometimes they're aggressive and take over the site at the exclusion of other things.
And noxious weed, is that a judgment?
Well, noxious weed is actually a formal designation that's made by the state noxious weed board, where certain species are identified as being a problem, mostly for agriculture. Some of them are problems for invading waterways and wetlands. So they're identified as a problem, and being designated as a noxious weed brings a legal requirement in some cases to control them. There's different levels of noxious weeds, but that does have a very specific meaning. I can't remember if digitalis is a noxious weed according to the state board. Well, yeah, but like for example, dandelions, we might choose to get rid of dandelions. That's not a noxious weed by the state, noxious weed.
Well, Forest Service has asked us to.
Oh, they have. Okay, well, there you go.
To get rid of foxglove?
Yeah.
And the oxeye daisy.
Yeah, the oxeye daisy is what's called a class C weed, not SEA. No, this is seaweed. And it is designated by the state noxious weed board as class C weed. And a class C weed is up to local jurisdictions to decide if they want to remove it or not. So it's not a real simple legal system, but it is a legal system. The Forest Service, being a federal agency, is not under the requirements of the state noxious weed board. They have their own, they make their own judgments about what they consider to be problems.
And that's true for the foxglove.
And that's true for the foxglove and the oxeye daisy. And there's another pretty common one around here. I think they've included the Dalmatian toad flax. Is that right?
In
their list of
butter
species
eggs.
To remove. The butter eggs.
Yeah.
Oh. And I haven't seen that one. I would have picked to bring that.
I saw some.
Oh, yeah. Did you have a question?
In Minnesota, I began to call that one a noxious weed because my mother planted them many, many years ago, and you can't get rid of them.
Yeah.
They just multiply and multiply.
Yeah.
And while they're pretty, you get a little tired of them if you have to fight them all the time.
Right.
I don't live in the apartment now anymore, but just.
Right. Yeah, and they're especially a problem in agricultural settings.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
What type of damage do they do in agricultural settings?
Well, in an agricultural setting, they would just be competing with crop species.
For the nutrients?
Yeah, for the space and the nutrients. And possibly also because it'd be a contaminant in the product. If you're growing a seed crop like grain, you don't want to harvest other seeds with the grain.
Well, what about wild mustard then? Some of our fields are just yellow with wild mustard. They've seeded them with oats or whatever, and they're just yellow with
yeah,
wild
mustard.
That would be considered a noxious weed, would it not?
So there are mustards that are designated as noxious weeds by the state.
I think that must be what we have.
Yeah, there's a lot of different species of mustard. More questions?
Joe,
yeah.
You talk about the different kinds of daisies today?
The different kind of what?
Different kinds of daisies.
No. Okay, so it's interesting that you're interested in noxious weeds because it's usually not a real hot topic. But to an ecologist, it's a very big topic because it's one of the major ecological changes that we're seeing. So we see an ecology now that we've never seen before and that will never be returned to the native condition. We use native to mean at the time of European settlement. Now, the forested habitats, like up here, are much less affected. If you go out of the area of disturbance, not the Golden Village is just a disturbance, it's a flowering disturbance or a flower of disturbance, but if you go away from the village, you don't see much, or away from the trails, you don't see many non-native species. It's not a, the forest is not a habitat that's particularly vulnerable. But grasslands, where there's grazing, agricultural lands, those are extremely vulnerable. Wetlands, and so those are completely altered, or radically altered. And whatever management decisions we make in the future, we can't, in most cases, hope to go to some prior condition. So anyway.
Would it become a problem if it, I mean, with species being moved around and with weeds sometimes just all of a sudden becoming noxious? Does it ever become a problem to keep up with that?
Yes, it's a big problem. People involved in restoration are trying to restore disturbed habitat, restore streams, wetlands, any kind of habitat, prairie, sagebrush. The number one problem are those species, noxious weeds, or non-native species that have come in and upset the prior condition. So, a flower is this particular unit or particular thing, and I'll describe these parts so that when we look at some slides and we look at some of the plants around here, we have some terminology we can use. When I say what's the corolla look like, or how many stamens, or what's the ovary look like, you'll know what I'm talking about. So, there's four parts. Most important are the reproductive parts, male and female. And start with the female part. It has three parts. It has an ovary where the eggs are born or carried. There may be just a single ovule or egg cell within this ovary, or there may be literally millions. Some of the orchid species have an ovary that contains millions, I'm told, of seeds. And then there's an elongate portion here. It's usually elongate, called the style. And the function of the style is to place the stigma, which is the part of the flower that's receptive to pollen, up in an appropriate position. And those three parts together are called the pistil. That's not really pistii. That's an L right there. Lost a part of the overhead loss. It's not a typo, though. Overhead lost a little piece of ink there. So, pistil, three parts, that's the female part. The male part is simpler, as males typically are. It only has two parts. It has a stalk, it's called a filament, and it has anthers, which contain pollen. This is where pollen happens. If I say meiosis, does anybody know what I mean? Okay, I'm just going to leave that discussion right out of it. But meiosis is the process where some other kind of cell becomes a pollen grain, or some other kind of cell becomes an egg cell. So, two parts, male and female, stamens and pistils. That's all you really need for sexual reproduction to happen in flowers.
There's two. Are they ever present both on one flower?
Yes. Yes, this is a typical diagrammatic flower, but the variation on how these parts are arranged is very wide, or almost unlimited. You may have both parts in one flower, like my diagram. You may have just one of the two. And the opposite might be born on the same individual plant or another plant. So there's every kind of variation. You may or may not have these other parts associated with it, which is what I'll talk about next. But yeah, there's all kinds of variation. But for a flowering plant to be functional, it's got to have both of these somewhere in the species. It doesn't have to even be on the same individual.
So flowers often pollinate themselves?
Sometimes they do. a wide diversity of mechanisms for either self-pollination, ensuring self-pollination, or preventing self-pollination. There's no one system that works. There's a wide diversity. Then there's two other parts, and these are named by how they're arranged on the stalk of the plant. On the outside, there's a calyx, which is made up of sepals. It's usually green, and its function is usually to protect the flower as it's developing. Notice that little word usually, because that's the biggest word we'll encounter in any of our discussions about flowering plants. It's usually, because there's so much diversity, there's exceptions to almost everything I'll say. So we have to pay a lot of attention to that little word usually. The corolla is usually the colored part, the brightly colored showy part of the flower that serves the function of attracting a pollinator. And the corolla is made of petals, a flower petal. It's a good botanical term that you all know, I'm sure. So that's it. That's the four main parts: calyx, corolla, stamens, and pistils. We'll use that language. Now there's another part that is not on this diagram because it's not formally part of a flower, but it's called a bract, B-R-A-C-T, bract. And a bract is just a leaf, a modified leaf. But we find that often the functions of the corolla or the calyx get taken on by leaves, by bracts. So I'll point some things out to you that you may not know are not flowers at all, or not parts of flowers. Okay? Any questions about this? Because now we'll look at some pictures.
What's the corolla's job if the flower is self-pollinating?
Then it may not have any function. And if it's self-pollinated, it may not even have a corolla anymore. A corolla may be lost. Or another case, if this flowering plant becomes wind pollinated, then it may not have any of the showy stuff at all. Because if it's pollinated by the wind, there's no need to attract pollinators. Yeah.
Usually, black flower, large flower
that doesn't have any petals.
If you look at it, it looks bizarre.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know?
No, you'll have to show that to me. I haven't seen
it. Yeah. It's just a...
No corolla. Yeah, I'll show you some pictures of plants that don't have any corolla at all. Any other questions about the diagram? Okay, let me turn this projector on over here. See if we can see something. I have this
projector. Basically, it's the box club. I mean, I haven't really seen it other than the rock wall.
What's the basis of it?
What?
You mean what? I'm sorry, I'm not hearing the question.
I was just asking Jen how invasive the...
Oh, how invasive it is.
...was throughout the buildings. And I haven't seen other than on the roadway. Well,
it's up around Art Lake and a lot of the trails go up.
Is it?
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
We might come back to that. Okay, well, the hard part of the biology class is over, so put away your notebooks. And there won't be any quiz. It's an old trick to tell people there will be. But I'll show you some of these forms that these four parts take. It's entangled here. Well, I started with this one. This is a plant I studied for about 4 years for my master's thesis. So it's very familiar to me. And I was studying two. I don't have a picture of the other species, but this is called catch fly. And this particular one grows in the high mountains. I chose it for two reasons. One, because it's very close to another species, which is a little smaller, grows up higher. And so there was some taxonomic confusion. Taxonomy is just naming. That's what we use the term to mean naming. And so my professor thought it would be a good subject to study to clarify if they were really just one species that had some variation. And the second choice was because it the two species happened to overlap in the high mountains of the North Cascades, which is exactly where I wanted to spend my time. So it took me about a week of hiking around the Cascades to determine that these are clearly distinct species. It took me about 4 years to finish my degree. That's the way it sometimes goes. But it's called Perry's Catch Fly. And in this one, here's the calyx. See this little tubular thing? In this case, the calyx formed of sepals. Now, if these are new terms to you, by the time we're done here, you at least will have heard them a lot. So hope maybe you'll understand what they mean by them. But the calyx is tubular. The separate sepals have been fused into a tube. And that happens to be a characteristic of this catch fly. And the petals are separate, and they're deeply lobed, like this right here. And I don't know if you can see it, but there's some additional little appendages that are attached to the petals. And the taxonomy is all based on how many of those appendages there are and how they're shaped and all those kinds of things.
And does it catch flies?
No. Its name is because it's sticky. And maybe occasionally a fly might get stuck to it.
So it's C-H-E-C-H?
Yes, catch fly. But it's not like an insectivorous plant or anything like that. That's just what its name is. It's another name is campion or silene. It's another name. There is, this is the genus. I'll have to go into a little Latin just for a second. The genus is silene. And there are some growing in the garden, I know. It's not this species, but a different one. And if you get a fix on this fused calyx, tubular calyx, and divided petals, you might pick it up out in the garden there. It's also a weed. It's not a noxious weed, but the one growing in the garden here is a non-native. Well, this is called a clustered saxifrage. And just to use this as an example of a very general type of flower that has separate petals, you can see it has five. One of the questions we ask when we look at an unidentified plant is how many petals does it have? Or what are the numbers of the floral parts? Are they in fives like this one? And you'll see that there's 10 of these little, what do you think these little yellow things are?
Stamens,
yeah. It looks like it has kind of an odd number, but probably if they're all there, there would be 10. So the stamens are in multiples of five. And you can't really see the pistil very well, but the pistil is in two parts. And that's a family characteristic of the saxifrage. That usually the pistil has two main divisions. But that's a very general five-parted flower. This happens to be a high alpine species. This is rock, and this plant is probably about a half an inch tall. It's a very small plant, grows plastered on the rocks. This is it's called Tweedy's Lewisia. This is one of the most beautiful flowering plants in Washington, native plant. And it's fairly rare. It's not formally designated as rare now because there's quite a bit of it in certain locations. But in this case, there's an indefinite number of petals. Like we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 here. They're probably not all the same. That's 8. But in general, it's not a very specific number. The same with the stamens. There's a large number of stamens in there. That's something we'd look at. You know, floral number. That's a characteristic. Here's another one that appears to have sort of an indefinite number of petals. But one of the things I'll point out about this is that these aren't petals at all. that these are sepals, part of the calyx. And this particular plant doesn't have any petals. So this is a case where the function of the petals has been taken over by the sepals. They've become the part that's showy and that acts to attract pollinators. Now you might ask, well, how do you know those aren't the petals and there aren't any sepals? They're all, these four parts are named, or the, especially the calyx and the corolla, are named by where they're placed on the developing flower. They're not named by their function. So as they're placed, they're the lowest of the four parts, and so technically they're sepals. This is an anemone, or windflower, or it's also called past flower because it flowers early in the spring, around the time of Easter. This is another high mountain species. It grows in the alpine ridges around here. It grows around the, like Cloudy Pass, and it probably grows on Martin Peak, on Bonanza, pretty high elevation. Maybe would you mind focusing that a little bit?
I might not be the right person for this assignment.
See how you do.
My eye situation.
Oh, that's a big improvement.
Okay.
Sorry to give you that job without having you volunteer for it.
Fine.
If you're willing,
that would probably
save me stepping on somebody's toes. Save Betty's toes if I have to go back and forth. This is one of our cactus. This grows down in the sagebrush in Washington, a hedgehog cactus. But here's another example of an indefinite large number of petals and a huge number of stamens. And then right in the middle, there's a single pistil.
Where's the sagebrush in Washington?
Well, actually, along Lake Chelan, there are little patches of sagebrush habitat. Or sagebrush steppe, it's called. It isn't. And it, as you go to about the town of Chelan is where it started. But Washington has tens of thousands of square miles of sagebrush. A very large portion of the state is not forested, but in sagebrush steppe, dominated by grasses.
How do you think that cactus would normally grow, would normally be native in places seems the Cascades?
Well, they're not, actually, not the Cascades. But in Washington, as you go just east of the Cascades, there's lots of cactus.
Those cactus are usually made for dry conditions because they can sort of soak up water and keep water.
That's right. That's right. And the two dry places in Washington are right along the salt water, south facing slopes where there are cactus, and right in the eastern parts of the state where it's dry. There's a little close-up of the same one, showing single pistil, lots of stamens, and huge number of petals. Now maybe, could I ask you to focus that one a little bit too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, a big change, yeah. Now this is kind of an oddball, and I'm looking to see if it actually has parts in six, and it's actually got an unusual number. This is in the iris family. This is called Cicerinchium. And I wanted to point out that this is in one of the big groups of flowering plants that usually have parts in three, but this is sort of an atypical one. Usually, as photographers are attracted sometimes to unusual ones, and this is the only one I've ever seen that had these stripes on it. And so it's an unusual example of this Cicerinchia. But it's also unusual in the number of flower parts, so I don't know what was going on with it.
How big is that?
It's about 6 inches tall. It's a very, very early flowering. One of the first flowers that appears in the spring. Low elevation mostly, but into the eastern parts of the Cascades also.
Does it have anything to do with focus?
Well, it's in the same family. I actually have to say, I think, because I haven't dealt with crocus since it isn't a native species, so put a question mark on that. Looks like a crocus, doesn't it? This is a lily, and this is a chocolate lily. This photograph was taken in Alaska, but this species grows in Washington. It's a rare plant in our state, but in Alaska it's very widespread, and it's used as a food crop. It was a food plant by the native people. And is it a food plant? Very abundant. But I put it in to show you that this is in the lily family, and lily family is characterized, among other things, by having floral parts in threes, or multiples of three. And if you can count these, you'll see there's six of these things that look like petals. And there's also, if you can see it, it's quite dark. This is a sort of dark chocolate. It's a chocolate lily. Get it? Dark chocolate. And it's got the styles of the ovary are also in threes. And that's a family characteristic.
What do they eat? Yeah, what part do they eat?
They eat the roots. Yeah, they're corms or bulbs that form in the roots. And it was dug as a source of starch.
Do they cook it?
It is dug, yes. As we go along, I'll often refer to families. And the reason I'm doing this is that when a botanist confronts an unknown, the first question that he or she asks is, well, what's the family? It's the first step in sort of identification. And it's sort of the working unit that people deal with on a daily basis. And if you learn families, the families are, in many cases, very widespread. And anywhere you go, you'll encounter the same families. So if you learn the 20 or so common families in Washington and went back to the Midwest or anywhere in the temperate world, you'd encounter the same 20 or so families. So it's a little bit of information that you can take with you wherever you go. And so that's what I'll point out, sometimes family characteristics. This other next one is also lily, and this is also sometimes called chocolate lily. This is a more kind of white chocolate or milk chocolate lily. But this is along Lake Chelan. This is called Fritillaria. And quite abundant in some places, flowering in the spring. But you can see it also has these parts in threes or multiples of three. It has six of these things that look like petals and three of the styles. Now, just to confuse you or throw another term, I keep saying they look like petals. In the lily family, the sepals and the petals look exactly the same. And so we use this other word, which is tepal or tepal, to refer to the fact that they're undifferentiated. So I might say this has six tepals, or I could say it has six things that look like petals. Because three of them formally would be petals, and three of them formally would be calyx. But for your purpose, if you just note the parts in multiples of three, and that's a characteristic of the lily family.
Is there a way then to look at those and see which ones are calyx and which ones are petals?
Probably not.
Okay.
It might be hard to see. They'll probably appear to be in one whorl. So it might be hard to distinguish between them. Here's another lily. Same thing. It's got six of these tepals. And I think you might be able to count six stamens. This is a blue camas, which was another food plant that was and is widely gathered by native people. The bulbs are dug and roasted for eating. The story is that they're not easy to digest and cause a great deal of flatulence, actually. The story goes, Lewis and Clark were dined on these and I can't quote exactly how he said it, but the response was quite dramatic.
Is there difficulty in distinguishing that from the death panels?
There is when the plants are not flowering. There is another, this is the, again, I'll lapse into Latin just to clarify something. This is the genus Camassia, which is called blue camas, and it's a food plant. There's another genus which is called Zygodinus, which is also a lily, which is poisonous. And the growth of the plant looks identical except the flower is entirely different. And they grow in the same place. And the plants are gathered for food when the flowers are not visible. So it's somewhat of a danger for people gathering this for food that they could dig up the death camels. And so there's a lot of widely understood that the native people actively went out and weeded out the patches where they gathered the camels and pulled out the death camels. There's no confusion when the flowers are present. They're very different. Here's another picture of the same thing. This, you can see the stamens. I think maybe we've lost one here, but there should be six. And six tepals. This is called giant blue camas. When it dries, the tepals twist around like this. Now, another thing that the corolla can do, another question we ask when we look at flowers is floral parts, how many there are, what the numbers are. But then another one is, are the petals fused? Is the corolla fused together into a tube? And this is a type of gentian, bog gentian, which grows up here in the subalpine meadows. It flowers fairly late in the summer. But in these, which are one of my favorite flowering plants, really beautiful flowers, the corolla is fused into a tube. And here's an example of where these are two sagebrush plants. This is called bluebells, not too surprising. Called yellow bells, also not too surprising. This is a lily, which does not have fused. See, these petals are separate, but they're functioning as if they're fused. They're functioning as a bell. But this one, which is a different family, the corolla has been fused into this long tube. You can see the calyx here, corolla. And this is a member of the same family. This is probably the rarest plant in Washington. This is called showy stick seed. And it only occurs in a very limited area just outside of Leavenworth. And it was just given federal status. I think it finally became formal last year as a federally endangered species. It also, you can't see it from this photo, I don't think, particularly, but it also has a fused, the lower part of the corolla is fused into a tube, and the upper part, the petals are separate.
How big is this?
It's about an inch, the flowers are about an inch across.
An inch.
Or 3/4 of an inch. It's a really showy plant. So, some of the rare plants are very, are not showy, they're hard to see. But some of them are very beautiful, and that one is particularly beautiful. This is a shooting star. This is another example of how the flower has a specialized structure for the purpose of pollination. This is another one here. A close-up. These are the petals that are sweeping back here. You can't see the calyx. And in this, the stamens are fused together into a tube. And the stigma is sticking out right there. So many different flowering plants of different families have this hanging over shape, where it's an adaptation for a certain kind of pollinator behavior, where a pollinator has to come up and hang on this flower to get at the nectar that's in it. After pollination, this will stand up, the stalk will straighten back up. And when you see the fruits developing, they'll be standing upright. And that's the case in lots of, this is a shooting star, which is in the primrose family. There's a, those lilies that we looked at that were hanging over, chocolate lily, those do the same thing. Once pollination is complete, the plant goes back into an upright. So we think of this pollination strategy as a specialization. Well, another thing, maybe I could ask you to focus that a little bit for me. There we go. Thank you very much. This is a mountain heather, pink mountain heather, which grows up here very abundantly in our area right above Holden. And in these, the corolla is fused into a tube. Also to facilitate pollination, you can see the style sticking out here in each one. I'm going to go past, well, no, I'll stop with this one. This is a yellow mountain heather. And it this example doesn't look bright yellow, but it is yellow. And this has a very strong adaptation. The corolla is fused into this bowl shape with a very narrow opening. And this has what's called buzz pollination. A bee will come and hang on that opening and buzz. And the buzzing is it vibrates the flower and causes the pollen to shake down and collect on the belly of the bee. And then when the bee goes to the next flower, that pollen, which is on its chest here, comes in contact with the, we'll back up and show you on this one, comes in contact with this, the stigma. So pollination can happen. I always think it's sort of a, surprising that pollination is so successful.
Yeah.
It seems kind of like a long shot that some bee is going to go visit one flower and then another. But every single one of those pollination events says that's exactly what's happening. So it's a much more reliable process than you'd think. So yellow heather and pink heather. Occasionally these two will hybridize. This is a hybrid of those two. And I don't know if you can pick it out, but there's the floral structure is very similar to that yellow one. It's got a very narrow opening. Remember this, this has a narrow opening like this. But it's also in color more close to the pink one, which is bright, wide open. And both of the parental species are very common and widespread, but occasionally if they grow in contact with each other, you'll find one or two hybrids. But the hybrids don't seem to do very well outside of that zone of overlap. So you don't really see that continuing on.
Doesn't heather also reproduce by spreading and growing roots as it's a surface?
Yeah, as far as I know it does. A lot of plants do. I mean, the flowers are all the mechanism of sexual reproduction, which gives rise to new individuals, new genetic, absolutely unique genetic configurations. But there's many mechanisms for vegetative reproduction, which is widespread and produces clones or identical copies. Well, another question. Yeah, thank you very much for being the focus here. It would be a much fuzzier presentation without your effort. So we've had several things we've looked at in floral structure. One is the number of floral parts. You know, how many petals are there, how many stamens. That's one trait. Another trait we've looked at is fusion. Are the calyx fused together? Are the corolla fused together? A third question is symmetry. And this is an example of a flower that has bilateral symmetry, where the flower cannot be cut into pie-shaped pieces that are the same, but it can be cut in half into two halves that are the same. Just like us, we're bilaterally symmetrical, more or less. Probably all a little bit lopsided. The same with some of these flowers. This is a bilaterally symmetrical flower. So that's a trait that we use to distinguish between different groups. Here's another one. This is a violet. It's got bilateral symmetry. Same thing. Got five petals and bilateral symmetry. I didn't tell you the name of this. This is a monkey flower. And there's many species of monkey flower that grow around here. One of the showy plants. There's a common one. This is called, yellow monkey flower, they call it. And there's another one which is sort of purple in color called Lewis's monkey flower, named after Lewis and Clark. And if you go up to Holden Lake, I think there's a pretty good patch of that along the way, that purple monkey flower. The bilateral symmetry, another thing to look for. And then there's also some very, very great specialization for pollination. This is an orchid. It's probably our showiest orchid. We have a number of native species of orchid. Most of them are pretty small, but this one is a big showy one called Mountain Lady Slipper. And here's a little closer view. You have to do some thinking to figure out in this one, well, what's the calyx, what's the corolla, you know, because all these structures have been highly modified. I think that the petals, I think this the pouch, which is really an insect trap, a trap that lets the insect get away, but it uses it for pollination in the meantime, that this is part of the corolla, or a modified petal. And I think that these three are modified parts of the calyx. There's a side view of it. It's a very specialized. You might know moccasin flower from Minnesota, or from the Midwest, or from New England, where I used to live. Moccasin flower is also a cypripedium, or lady slipper orchid. Has anybody seen that pink one that's from the east? Have you seen it? It wasn't widespread, but I remember seeing it as a child scattered in the woods here and there.
One spring here, the North Glacial was just, I've never seen so many.
With lady slippers?
Yeah, with this color. No, they were pink.
They were pink. No, that was probably fairy slipper.
Oh, okay.
Different kind of footwear.
Oh,
and I have a picture of that here too. So that's coming. This one, this plant stands a couple feet tall.
Oh wow!
It's a big showy orchid. I don't think we ever reported it from the lakeshore sawtooth area. Not to say we saw everything that was there.
No, it was the other. I thought this was that. It wasn't showing the pink color.
That's an even greater close-up. This orchids have a specialized structure. They put all of their eggs in just a few baskets, so to speak, as far as pollination goes. That they all of the pollen, thousands or maybe literally millions of pollen grains, are put in these packets, these clumps, that when an insect enters this flower into a very specific position, this clump of pollen gets glued on the back of it. And so instead of, you know, just putting a few grains out with each pollinator, it puts out this whole packet. And then when the fruit develops, which is not as likely as maybe if they had a more scattered method, the fruit is the one that I described earlier that may have up to a million very tiny seeds. So there's different strategies that work. And in this case, the strategy is to have a very specialized pollination, but then produce literally millions of seeds. And most of those seeds never develop. But the strategy on this orchid's part is if you make enough of them, occasionally one or two are going to land in the right conditions, in the right environment, and succeed. This is the one you're probably talking about, or thinking of. This is fairy slipper, which is another orchid with very specialized type of flowering plant. It just has a single leaf for each flowering stalk. So plant is a flowering stalk, one flower, and a single leaf. So there's three of them here. This is called Calypso, also called Calypso. Might have heard that. Jacques Cousteau named his boat after this farm. Or maybe he named it after the, was it a Greek, or was it a Greek goddess, Calypso? Isn't it, you know? So maybe he named it after that Calypso. This is another native orchid. And this is a coral root. And I've noticed, we noticed some of this the other day growing up by the ballpark, in the woods there next to where the labyrinth is. And these are, it's a whole other topic, but these are non-photosynthetic plants. They don't make any of their own chlorophyll. They don't make any of their own food. And they're parasites on a conifer through the medium of a fungus. So this is one of the topics for, it's either Friday or Saturday on symbiosis, but there's a very complex interconnection between three different types of organisms. And effectively, this plant is parasitizing some other plant. This is another highly specialized plant. This is called bird beak lousewort. And it grows up here in I think it grows in Copper Basin. It grows in that kind of place, kind of moist subalpine basin. And it's got this very specialized floral shape. The corolla is specially shaped so that it can place this stigma out in the right position for coming in contact with a pollinating insect in the right place. There's a number of, this is the member of a genus called Pedicularis, or lousewort. It's kind of a mouthful. But there's a number of species in Washington, and each of them is highly specialized for putting pollen on a very specific place on an insect. I've been told by people who study them that a single insect could have pollen from three different species on it. And the pollen would be in a precise location, a species-specific location. There's another one called elephant head, which has big petals that look like ears and a style that looks like an elephant's trunk. And it's even got a little landing platform for the pollinating insect. The insect lands on the platform and the pollen gets applied in a very specific location. And then when it goes to another flower of the same species, it's in position for making contact with it. Seems like I said, like an unlikely mechanism to be successful, but lo and behold, it is. This is a clematis, or do people say clematis here?
Yeah.
Some people say clematis, some people say clematis. I'm of the persuasion that however you say these names is fine. But this clematis grows across the lake a lot on Sawtooth Ridge, and I would expect it would grow around here on the ridges too. But it's an example where this large thing that looks like a petal is really the calyx. And you can see that there isn't, you don't see any calyx here. That's because the calyx has taken on the showy part. It's become the showy part of the flower. And all these things hanging down here are stamens. One of the problems with any kind of presentation like this is that when you are looking at an infinite topic, you have to pick just one little piece to look at. And if we had a lot of time and interest, we could learn each of the flowering plant families and what their characteristics are. But I'll just tell you about this family. This is the buttercup family, which doesn't look like a buttercup superficially, but one of the characteristics of the buttercups is that it has a large number of stamens. And if you look at buttercups in the gardens around here, take one look at it closely, you'll see that it doesn't look anything like this, but it does have this characteristic of a large number of stamens. And there's other many other characteristics that make it a buttercup too, but that's one. Now this is a type of saxifrage. It's scientific, I'll give you a scientific name. It's called Saxifraga integrifolia variety A petala. And or it's called swamp saxifrage. It doesn't grow in a swamp. Probably its greatest abundance certainly its greatest abundance that I know of is right across the lake here up in the upper parts of Sawtooth Ridge. So, and it doesn't grow in swamps, it kind of grows in dry subalpine meadows. But the part about its name the thing about it that I want to point out is that it doesn't have any petals. That what you see are the calyx, this greenish calyx, and you can see the stamens, you can see the pistil in the middle, and it's a saxifrage, and its pollination is achieved by the whole head, or what would you call this whole head? It's not a flower, it's an inflorescence, right? The whole inflorescence acts as the attractant for the pollinator. So the pollinator has still got to, if pollination is going to happen, still has to be attracted to this thing. And apparently the petals have become vestigial or not necessary, and so it's for some reason lost the petals, but survived in spite of that. Its variety is apetala, meaning no petals. There are other varieties that look just like this, but do have petals. And the shape of the inflorescence is not so much like a head, it's more diffuse. Well, I put this in to show you, to point out to you that grasses are flowering plants too. And if we looked at that original, the diagram that we looked at the very beginning, grasses would be under that phylum of flowering plants. But because they're pollinated by the wind, they don't have any, there's no need for showy flower parts. So they've lost entirely petals and sepals. But they do have the male and female stamens and pistils. If you get hay fever, that's because those stamens are putting out lots of pollen. And being carried by the wind. Now here's a bunch of inflorescences. Balsam root, which is in the sunflower family, and I don't have time now to describe all the types of flowers here, but there's some that have these long petals like this, and in the middle there's a large number of flowers that don't have those long petals, they just are a very narrow little tube. You know the old "she loves me, she loves me not" thing? It's a gamble with one of these. You never know what's going to happen. Take a nice flower like buttercup with five petals, and then you have a little more sureness of coming out with a good result. Inflorescence, the inflorescence here attracting a pollinator. I'm going to run out of time here, so I'll flip through the rest. But bumblebees love yellow, and they love blue. So you'll often find flowers pollinated by bees being one of those two colors. And he had such a great idea that several more decided to do the same thing. So we got three here. I thought that was kind of a neat little choreography of working together. And here's another inflorescence. Each of these little pieces is a flower. They're not all entirely open. But some of them are open, and they act together as a unit, as an attractor of pollinators.
What are the names of the flowers that you find in the last slide?
Let's go back here, I'll show you. This is a goldenrod, which is a Canadian goldenrod. There's many different species, but that's a common one. And that grows here, grows in the valley, I'm sure. I don't know if I missed one, didn't give you a name for that. Yeah, balsam root. So goldenrod, and then this is a type of desert parsley, or genus Lomatium. And it has this kind of broad, flat inflorescence. And there's the pollinator. He got, he or she, or she, I should say, I'm sure it's a she, was successfully attracted, and there she goes. This is another inflorescence. Now, this is a legume. This is a big-headed clover. But each of these, this right here is a flower. And this right here is a flower. And so they function together to attract pollinators.
And what did you say this is?
This is called big-headed clover.
Where do you see that?
This is a sagebrush species. So if you went to Chelan, and probably Chelan Butte, the city of Chelan Butte, you might run into this. This picture was taken over by Ellensburg.
Is that an ant crawling on it?
I think it is. Now, I'm not, I would expect that ants may occasionally act as a pollinator, but probably very rarely. I have heard of ants being a very important distributor of seeds, carrying seeds around. Now, the last thing I wanted to show you was that, if you remember looking at that floral diagram, I said that the one thing that isn't on there is the bract. And a bract is a type of leaf that might be modified in many different ways. Well, this is a skunk cabbage, and this is a bract, or a leaf. And this is an inflorescence. And each of these little things is a flower. So it's a case where the flowers have been formed this compact inflorescence. And then a leaf nearby, this bract, takes on the role of attracting a pollinator. So the function, the parts aren't named by their function in particular. This is another case. This is paintbrush. Very beautiful flowering plant. Grows around here. And most of that red that you see is not flowers at all. Most of the red are leaves or bracts, which are modified for serving the function of attracting insects or hummingbirds. Indian paintbrush, being bright red, is a favorite food plant of hummingbirds. And when you see patches of this in the mountains, often the hummingbirds will be aggressively protecting that patch because that's their food source. This little green thing here is actually the flower. That's the most of the corolla. It's that green piece right there.
Then do the hummingbirds pollinate?
Yeah. The hummingbirds are the pollinators in most cases.
Part of the bee family.
This is called bunchberry, or sometimes called Canadian dogwood, and very common here in the valley. This is another case where these white things are not petals. They're not formally part of the flower at all, but they are leaves which are serving the purpose of attracting pollinators. And in the center here are flowers. These are an inflorescence of many flowers. And I can't see in there well enough to know what the calyx and corolla look like, but their function has been taken over by the leaves. So I'm going to leave it there. We've run out of time. We haven't run out of topic, and never will. So are there any questions before we go off to...
You mentioned way back to that one rare flower sticky or something that was
really
Is the Leadwood area particularly rich for flowers? I mean, a few years ago, a couple of us went hunting for the leafy treaty eye in the west end of the Tumwater Canyon and found tons of them.
Yeah.
Is it a particularly rich area for wildflowers?
I guess I would have to say yes. It is a particularly rich area. There's a Hey, let me turn the lights on here. There's a range of mountains there that
just know how to live.
There's a range of mountains there called the Wenatchee Mountains, which are a serpentine deposit. And serpentine is a type of soil which is rich in iron and magnesium, and it's somewhat toxic to plants. But because of that, it's sort of a hotbed for unusual things, because very few things have been able to survive those conditions, and so there's a lot of specialization that goes on. So the serpentine outcrops become centers of diversity. Kind of strange, you'd think it'd be the other way around, but that's how it seems to work.
What about the bunch tray? Because you try to plant it down here, it grows in, I don't know,
your
heart and holding. Yeah. Just one area, you try to transplant it down.
And you haven't been successful.
Special soil?
I don't think so. And why you haven't been successful, I don't know. I've never tried transplanting it. It might be worth trying from seed, maybe. Some things don't transplant very well. Maybe that's what it is.
Well, the moccasin, or the lady slippers, we call it, we transplanted some by my mother's house, how many years ago? And I did not look this spring because I'm in town now.
Yeah.
But it has come, one that and one Jack in the Hobbit.
Oh, yeah.
And they have continued to grow in that one spot on the north side of her house.
For how many years?
Since 1960.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the modern age, it's usually frowned upon, you know, digging up plants.
But I know it is.
I know. I'm not, you know, criticizing your mother. And I've also, when I thought it was appropriate, transplanted things of nature, but I had an uncle back in Maine who did the same thing. He transplanted some of those moccasin flowers, and they persisted as long as he was on that.
I guess it's illegal in Minnesota, really, but they don't check up. It's like cutting the tree. We aren't supposed to have bouquets of trees in the spring, but there's thousands of them in the woods.
Right, in certain areas. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you.